Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, Gilded Age Hotels at Florida's Mineral Springs.
People were attracted to these watering places, like the watering places of Europe.
We'll discuss Tampa shipyard workers in World War I.
During the war, 17% of the workforce at Tasco and McCloskey was female, the highest in the nation.
And we'll talk about Cuban consulates in Key West. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. During the Gilded Age of the late 1800s and early 1900s, some grand hotels were built in Florida. Many of these hotels were constructed near mineral springs and were marketed as health resorts. Rick Kilby is author of the book Florida's Healing Waters.
They were built around mostly smaller springs. For some reason, they didn't build health spas at the large first magnitude springs like Rainbow Springs and Silver Springs. They were mostly small third magnitude springs that had a lot of minerals in the water that you usually could tell by the sulfur smell that you smell, for example, at Green Cove Springs that just reeks, because they believed that those minerals were good for you either to drink or to soak in.
Some of these Gilded Age hotels included architectural structures that surrounded or even enclosed the springs. Kilby says that the most notable of these would be at White Sulfur Springs in the town of White Springs, where the annual Florida Folk Festival is held today.
It was owned by a Confederate widow named Minnie Mosier Jackson, and she hired an architectural firm out of Jacksonville to build this elaborate four-story structure that had a clinic and a gift shop and actually an elevator to get up and down. And it was remarkable, and it was perhaps the most notable architectural building that was created around a spring itself. It completely surrounded the spring on the Suwannee River. And it lasted until the 1970s, and it became part of Stephen Foster State Park. And the Park Service tore it down because it had gotten quite dilapidated. But the actual foundation is still there, and that first story is still intact. So you can walk around and see, kind of get, you see the vestiges of that bathing era in Florida.
Some of the Gilded Age hotels, like the one at White Springs, were wooden structures. Others around the state were built in a Mediterranean Revival style with white stucco and orange tile roofs.
Many of the ones along the St. John's River, which did kind of develop first, because Jacksonville was often the port that the people came to Florida at the end of the 19th century would start their visit to Florida at, and they would transfer in Jacksonville to steamboats and go up the St. John's River. So there were a number about 30 miles outside of Jacksonville, starting with Magnolia Springs, and then a mile away, Green Cove Springs. And those were mostly wooden hotels and very beautiful Victorian buildings. They often had a tower in the center or either on the ends of the building so people could go up there and see the views of the river. The St. John's, I don't know if you've been up there, is quite wide in that area, but it offered great views. They had big verandas that usually wrapped around so people could sit and rock and enjoy the views. Most of those did not survive until the 19th century. They were very susceptible to fire. Oftentimes, they would build a hotel and would burn down, be replaced by another wooden hotel, and then would burn down again. So it's really not until the early 20th century you started seeing some of the Mediterranean Revival style hotels being built, because that was kind of the flavor of the day during Florida's land boom. So you saw places like there was a hotel built at Ponce de Leon Springs in Volusia County in that style, and also early buildings at the springs in Safety Harbor that are known as the Espiritu Santo Springs were also built in the Mediterranean Revival style. And some of those still exist in Safety Harbor, and they have a room that is intact as it would have been in the 1920s. So if you want to see what it would have been like for visitors to stay there, you can still go there. It's kind of behind plexiglass.
Initially, paddle boats were the primary way to reach the hotels at Mineral Springs, but as Henry Flagler and Henry Plant built their railroad systems, access to the hotels increased.
When railroads came along, it opened up entire new areas, so the north part of the state caught up later. So White Springs that I talked about, Suwannee Springs, which was nearby, Dowling Park, Hampton Springs, Worthington Springs, all developed because of railroads. And it also gave it access to different parts of the country. So people from Georgia and the Carolinas could get there via railroad. And then eventually the ones that were along the St. John's River got railroads as well. So you could get there either by train or by boat, so it increased the access again. Some were always rural, and you had to take a carriage. So Orange Springs, for instance, which was off the Ocklawaha River, actually was on an old trail that went from Palatka to Tampa during the Seminole Wars, and was actually more popular before the Civil War than after the Civil War, because after the Civil War, the steamboats going up the Ocklawaha didn't really venture up Orange Creek, and so it was bypassed, and it just kind of was lost and became more of a recreational destination than a place for taking the waters.
Florida's mineral springs were the primary attraction at these Gilded Age hotels, but as Rick Kilby explains, they did have other amenities.
People were attracted to these watering places, like the watering places of Europe. And you would bathe in the water, and you would drink the water constantly. So they would, some places, they actually piped the water straight into the hotels, and you could get it in your room. Other places brought them in demijohns or in pitchers, and you constantly drank the water. But you needed a lot to do. So in Green Cove Springs, there was a promenade along the river. You could go up to Magnolia Springs. It was about a mile, called St. David's Walk, and that's, you know, one of the things you did, because it was like a society thing where you could wear your best clothes and be seen. But there was all sorts of things to do. They loved hunting and fishing. So, you know, on the steamboats, for instance, they would shoot alligators all the time. Anything that moved, they would basically shoot. Fishing was very big. Boat rides were very big. They had steam launches, and they loved sailing and taking, you know, rowboats and being on the water. But there was also things like, a lot of the hotels had bowling alleys. They had croquet on the grounds. Some of the places had horse racing. I believe Green Cove Springs had horse racing. And then later Sulphur Springs had a big racetrack, because, you know, that's the kind of leisure activities that people wanted. And Green Cove Springs was actually called the Saratoga of the South, emulating Saratoga Springs, New York, which we know is still known today for its racetrack. So they kind of copied a lot of the things. You know, there was shopping, there were theaters. These were mostly people of means who had a lot of money they could spend on things. So, you know, a whole economy is based on these hotels kind of developed. The best examples would be Green Cove Springs and White Springs, where the towns basically surrounded the springs. And other places were kind of like all-inclusive resorts. Hampton Springs is a good example of that, and Suwannee Springs as well, where, you know, you kind of stayed on the property and really didn't venture into the town.
These hotels were the height of luxury in the late 1800s and early 1900s. While very few remnants of them still exist, there are many postcards and photographs depicting them.
One of the most popular places that really you don't think of in terms of a spring is the Altamont Hotel in Altamont Springs, because when you see pictures of the spring, it looks like a little gazebo on the edge of a lake. And I imagine they probably just, you know, dipped a bucket in and drank the water. It didn't look like you could use it for bathing, but they piped the water in there. But that hotel was popular well into the 1950s, which is kind of an outlier for these places, because most of them had burned down again. And when it finally did burn down in the 1950s, the guests who visited there every single year were heartbroken, and they wanted the owner to rebuild because they loved that place so much. When I look at the pictures now, you know, they were the height of luxury in the 19th century, but to me, they look like old Florida. You know, it has that kind of old Florida vibe. You know, it looks like it's full of antiques, but back then it was full of contemporary furniture.
Rick Kilby is author of the book Florida's Healing Waters. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find out about upcoming events, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Early in the morning, she rises. Woman's work is never done.
Joining us now from the Library of Florida History in Cocoa is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, World War II transformed the United States. Pearl Harbor ended the nation's sense of security and isolation. The infusion of federal dollars to equip, train, and sustain armies in Europe and Asia ended the Depression. The migration of men and women into cities to fulfill the new defense jobs produced a permanent population shift from the countryside to urban centers. The demand for workers opened new job opportunities, however temporary, for women and minorities.
After the initial shock that accompanied the attack on Pearl Harbor, Tampans embraced the war in a surge of patriotism, according to Stacy Lynn Turner. In her spring 2007 article, Progress and Sacrifice, Tampa Shipyard Workers in World War II, she addresses what she sees as a lack of attention to the city's shipyards in Florida's World War II historiography. Indeed, she provides only two citations, Lewis N. Wynn and Carol Barnes' Still They Sail in Florida at War, and Gary R. Mormino's book, Hillsborough County Goes to War. As she explains, quote, while Wynn and Barnes dealt with the logistical and economic history of the shipyards, and Mormino focused on the labor history of the yards, her study is a reexamination of the social conditions of the workers. Work in the Tampa shipyards drew new workers into the labor market to meet the extraordinary demands of global warfare and undermined accepted gender, racial, and social constructs without immediately overthrowing them. A close look at the Tampa shipyards provides a window for understanding the shifts in working and living conditions and the changes in government policy that continued to affect American life long after the wartime jobs disappeared, end quote.
Connie, Tampa had a history of shipbuilding before World War II. How did that figure into the war efforts of the 1940s?
As Tanner explains, Tampa's shipbuilding originated in World War I when Ernest Krayer established Tampa Shipbuilding and Engineering Company in 1917. During the 1920s and early 1930s, the company languished but was revived by the Merchant Marine Act of 1936, which provided, quote, a market for new ships and a no-lose cost-plus incentives for shipbuilders and operators. In 1940, George B. Howell took over presidency of the Tampa Shipbuilding Company, which soon was known simply as TASCO. The company was joined by three smaller shipbuilding firms, Bushnell Lyons, Tampa Marine, and McCloskey. TASCO produced 76 ships and repaired 500 during the course of the war, including destroyer escorts, minesweepers, ammunition and cargo carriers, and barges. McCloskey built 24 concrete cargo carriers and 19 steel cargo ships. Of the two smaller firms, Bushnell Lyons built barges and Tampa Marine produced tugboats.
Recent World War II histories point to the roles played by women as personified by Rosie the Riveter and Wanda the Welder. Previously excluded from most skilled industrial jobs, these women came from a variety of backgrounds without the training needed to build ships, and yet they did just that.
Indeed, they did. Prior to the war, the only role women played in shipbuilding was the christening of new vessels with the requisite bottle of champagne. During the war, 17% of the workforce at TASCO and McCloskey was female, the highest in the nation. Shipbuilding was dangerous, even to the most skilled workers, but competition for the well-paid jobs was intense. As Tanner notes, quote, the diversity of life and work experiences the workers brought to the yards presented personal challenges for individual workers as well as supervisors who needed to develop teams of specialized laborers as quickly as possible, end quote. New workers went through an induction process at the yard's training center to orient them to the work environment and provide other company information. Some workers were assigned to more experienced shipbuilders to learn the skills they needed. Others were sent to Tampa's Brewster Vocational School or were hired from St. Petersburg Tomlinson Vocational School. Although the shipyards promoted safety, the work was inherently dangerous and made more hazardous by the rapid work pace demanded by military contracts, the long hours employees routinely worked, and the inexperience of the workers themselves. Horseplay and practical jokes intended to relieve the tension inadvertently contributed to some accidents. Job-related accidents included scrapes, burns, and bruises at the lower level of injury, but accidents also resulted in loss of limbs and life. In 1944, the Department of Labor and the National Safety Council recorded a nationwide death toll of defense workers at 94,000, with 312 million work hours lost. Worker safety continued to be a national concern, but even basic safety practices were not instituted until late in the war. For example, the Maritime Commission did not mandate the wearing of safety goggles until early 1945. Isla Graves, a former riveter, remembered accidents that ranged from painful burns to horrific scene of riveters falling to their deaths from their workspaces on the sides of ships. W.L. Purvis died of burns when he fell into a vat of acid in the pickling plant, where metal was treated with acid to prevent rust.
Connie, in addition to the dangers at work, shipyard workers, especially women, faced enormous pressures in their homes. Many were mothers and caregivers for older relatives. With housing shortages, transportation snags, food rationing, crowded schools, few childcare options, and worry about family members in the military, the personal burdens must have seemed insurmountable.
Tampa was not prepared for the influx of defense workers. Individuals and whole families were housed in whatever was available. Many ended up living in St. Petersburg and commuting to Tampa. Finding public transportation or carpools could be frustrating and time-consuming. Finding tires for automobiles to fit their cars and auto replacement parts proved challenging. Gasoline was rationed. Crowded parking lots were hazardous to pedestrians as drivers raced frantically to find parking spaces. By war's end, Americans were junking 4,000 cars per day as the result of poor maintenance. Two family stories demonstrate the personal dynamics of wartime work. Neva Todd, her husband and three children, lived on a farm before the war. They moved to Tampa so Isla could take a job at the shipyards. Her daughter Lucille, a child herself, stayed home to care for her younger brother, who suffered paralysis from a bout with polio. As Tanner observed, quote, daughters often paid a high price for the employment opportunities of their parents and older siblings, end quote. Isla Graves' daughter, Juanita, assumed the household duties of cooking, cleaning, and caring for a younger brother while her widowed mother worked at the shipyards. She did the food shopping with her family's ration books and stretched the family food budget by working in her school's victory garden to obtain fresh vegetables. Despite the hardships, Tanner concludes that the war brought together men and women with little experience to build ships for the war. They endured housing shortages and transportation snarls. Children of shipyard workers assumed responsibilities beyond their years to support their parents' employment in the war effort. Government agencies work to find resources to alleviate housing and transportation issues. Shipyard supervisors recognize that recreation was vital to a safe and efficient workplace and organize team sports, contests, and radio programs for their workers. In the end, Tanner argues, quote, "First and foremost, credit for the sacrifices made by those on the home front is due to women like Neva Todd and Isla Graves, who dropped what they were doing to join the war effort and spent long hours at work away from their families with little expectation of employment in the shipbuilding industry at the close of the war," end quote.
Fascinating history as always, Connie. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
She rises. Woman's work is never done.
This is Florida Frontiers. In the early 20th century, Cuba established consulates in Key West. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Arturo Sebastian Gonzalez is a PhD history student at the University of Miami. His research focuses on how Cuban migrants influenced political changes on and off the island throughout the long history of Cuban-American relations. Immediately after Cuba achieved independence from Spain in 1902, the Cuban state established several consulates across the United States, particularly in Florida. Cuban consuls' everyday task included assignments not so different from what consulates do today, such as facilitating economic relations between the two populations, issuing business visas, and paying import taxes for shipped goods. However, Arturo explains that during his early period of the Cuban Republic, there was a more concealed or hidden agenda behind establishing these consulates.
These consular offices also served a secondary purpose as part of a security apparatus that was intended to protect the Cuban Republic from Cuban emigres who sought to overthrow the government of the day.
Historians have thoroughly documented the political relationship between the diasporic Cuban community and the island's government regime, particularly during political transformations such as the Cuban War of Independence in the late 19th century or since Fidel Castro took over in 1959. However, such connections have not been adequately examined during the roughly half-century gap between those two momentous events.
In that in-between time, in what we call the Republican era from 1902 to 1959, there continued to be a few dissident elements in the Cuban emigre communities who at various times sought to overthrow the constitutional order or what they claimed was actually an unconstitutional order on the Republic from their place of residence, which could be Key West, Tampa, New York, and once Miami got established, the Magic City.
Interestingly, the consul in Key West was Domingo Milord, an emigre. Being at the intersection of the Cuban emigre and diplomatic communities enabled Milord to operate and connect with both groups.
In 1919, Domingo Milord was appointed to be the Key West consul, and he was himself an emigre. Now, that means that his interests were not different from his fellow emigres. And in communicating with the Cuban government in Havana, he was really operating in this in-between position. And that middle position gave him a lot of cachet among the Cubans of Key West.
One example in particular that demonstrates Milord's influence as an emigre consul, and by extension the significance of the Cuban consulate network in Florida, was in 1924, when a minor revolt broke out in Santa Clara, Cuba.
The Cuban ambassador to the United States, Cosme de la Torriente, convinced the U.S. State Department to impose an embargo on all arms shipments to Cuba, and he ordered all the consuls to be vigilant and to report any activity that might violate this order. So in Key West, the local consul, Milord, he goes into gear. He gets this order and he creates a poster himself and posts it in all of the public places where he knew that Cubans congregated, the plazas, the restaurants. And of course, he was able to do this because he himself was a Cuban emigre. So this was like him going to his usual spots anyway, but this time with a poster in tow. And we know that this poster was actually effective because on May 6th, after he had gotten the word out and sounded the alarm, a local Cuban emigre living in Key West informed him of a plot.
The plot seemingly involved a man smuggling arms to the Cuban rebels supporting the revolt in Santa Clara. With the assistance of the local Coast Guard commander, Milord further investigated the plot to quickly discover that there was no evidence to support such accusations. Nevertheless, the 1924 Santa Clara revolt was ultimately suppressed partly because of the broader consular network in Florida, operated by diplomats like Milord, whom one newspaper described as an acclaimed representative for La Colonia Cubana, the Cuban colony. Arturo explains why such language exemplifies the significance of these Cuban consulates during the early Republic era.
A colony that has the implication of political links to a metropole. Now, Key West was a territory of the United States through and through, and it, you know, must be considered U.S. territory. But that language of there being a Cuban colony in Key West, I think there's two ways to take it. One is the very romantic way to say, well, it's a colony in that their links to the Cuban homeland are cultural, that, you know, they are invoking a immigrant past. But I think that in reviewing some of this diplomatic correspondence, that term, Cuban colony, it actually does reference some political links that continue to exist between the Republic of Cuba and the Cuban emigres, who were operating under U.S. sovereignty, and yet nevertheless, they were still in some ways subject to the authority of the Cuban Republic.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit our content-rich website at myfloridahistory.org and find us on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.